Welcome to episode 24 of Indestructible, Indestructible, Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. This podcast is a collaborative effort between myself and Alborada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media, and culture based in the United Kingdom. I am a contributing editor of Alborada and am based in Sydney, Australia. If you like the content of this podcast, you may want to consider supporting us on Patreon. All of our patrons are now receiving a small selection of references to articles, podcasts, and books, which deal with some of the key topics discussed in each episode. Another way you can support us is by simply sharing this episode and letting your friends know about this podcast. You will find us on Spotify under the name Alborada, which is spelled A-L-B-O-R-A-D-A, and on Twitter and Facebook under Indestructible Podcasts. On Instagram, you will find us under the title Indestructible Pod. In November, Argentinians went to the polls in the final round of their country's presidential election, with the country suffering from staggering inflation and paying off a $44 billion US debt to the International Monetary Fund after former right-wing president Mauricio Macri requested the loan in 2018, life in recent years for most blue-collar and white-collar Argentinians has become incredibly difficult. The election runoff saw right-wing populist Javier Milei win the presidency with 56% of the vote. This was reportedly the widest victory margin in a presidential race since the South American country's return to democracy in 1983. Milei has been voted in on a radical neoliberal program promising to abolish numerous government ministries and drastically slash social spending. In order to understand Argentina's recent electoral result better and its ramifications for Argentina and beyond, I spoke to Dr. Francisco Dominguez, an expert on Latin American politics. Francisco is a former senior lecturer at Middlesex University in the UK. He is a co-editor of Right-Wing Politics in the New Latin America, Reaction and Revolt, published in 2011 by Zed Books, and comments regularly on Latin American politics for the British daily The Morning Star. I now leave you with Dr. Francisco Dominguez. Indestructible. Cuando en el alma se siente una herida. Indestructible. Dr. Francisco Dominguez, former senior lecturer at Middlesex University, thank you very much for joining us here at Alborada's Indestructible podcast. We are here to talk about Javier Milei, who has recently won the presidential election in Argentina, the ultra-right wing candidate who won by 56%. In a recent article that you wrote in the Morning Star, you stated, and I quote, "The election of Javier Milei as president will take Argentina into a gigantic and multifaceted crisis, leading his extreme right-wing administration to assault people's rights and gains. His promised brutal ultra-neoliberal policies will be supplemented by implacable repression and persecution of opponents." Before you tell our audience about Milei's policies, could you tell us a little bit about him as a political actor? What is his past? Why is he often called El Loco, the crazy one?
Yeah, I mean, there have been plenty of articles covering his biography. And there is a biography published about him, which is quite accurate. I don't mean to be insulting with what I'm going to say, because this is a purely descriptive description of his character. He seems to have serious psychological difficulties from very early on. One of the characteristics in the biography is somebody who is desperate to actually, you know, be noticed by everybody else. And he earned the nickname El Loco when he was a secondary school student, because exactly he was trying to, you know, sort of being seen all the time and doing silly things. He's got very peculiar behavior. For example, he's got four dogs who he's named after famous economists. That's one of the things that he seems to sort of, it's quite pejorative to do these is clearly what he intends to do. And Conan, one of his favorite dogs who's dead, he says he's in constant connection with him. He's constantly in contact with the dog. And he claims, not once, several times, you know, on national television, as well as in interviews, that he follows the advice that Conan gives him regarding politics, economics, and everything else. He lives with his sister. He seems not to have any partner of any kind whatsoever. Apparently, the first person, the first partner he had was when he was 33. And then he is sort of a weird character because he made his personality, he became famous because of television, where he talked about sexual stuff, sexual exploits that he's supposed to have performed over the years, things such as, well, I better don't describe what he said, but so
he's a very big character,
he's got very, very, very marked characteristics, you know, in his face and so on.
Hasn't he said he was a former sex therapist or something along those lines?
Yeah, he said he talked about threesomes and sex therapies, and he's able to perform extraordinary things and so on. I mean, you never know when you're doing one of these sensationalist chat shows on national television. God knows what people are asked to do or say in order to make what they call good television. So maybe that is the case. Nevertheless, overall, he's an odd character. He's very peculiar. He's sort of unusual in many respects. He's an outsider and he's extremely strange. He gets angry very quickly. He uses insults to refer to just about anybody he doesn't like. And he doesn't like a lot of people.
What does Milei propose for Argentina and how feasible is it, for example, to dollarize the economy? I understand he claims he wants to do this within the first year.
He said he wants to privatize everything that can be privatized. He wants to dollarize the economy, replace the peso with the dollar. Argentina has gone through this already. He says he wants to abolish the central bank, which is something maybe desirable from the point of view of right-wing economics, but it's technically almost impossible to actually carry out. He says he wants to reduce social spending from 38% of GDP to 15% of GDP, which would be massive, gigantic. And then he also announced during the electoral campaign that he wants to break all economic relations with Brazil and China. Later on, he moderated all of that, saying, actually, no, I want to maintain good relations with Brazil. And certainly has done the same regarding China. And all of this is a package that he wants to implement, including, you know, reducing social expenditure and reducing the size of the public sector by sacking workers, which is very likely what he's going to do. He said he's going to be implacable when it comes to anybody who organizes resistance to it. He says illegal resistance, but you know what we mean. So that's the package. And it's very simplistic. It's a sort of easy answers to very complex problems. And the economy of Argentina is a massive economy that if he were able to carry out this in the first year, it would produce a massive, I wouldn't say collapse, but very likely very near collapse, because it will destroy the economy almost completely. It's impossible for the Argentine economy to sustain such a level of changes and measures and economic policies he intends to implement.
Mm-hmm. I understand the markets reacted quite well to his election, but I'm guessing that's because precisely they're aware that he is going to privatize the state oil company, for example. So I'm guessing that's why they reacted well. I've been following Argentine politics since the country engaged in a massive default on December 23rd, 2001. the default was $95 billion debt. I understand the country's debt crisis though goes back to the days when the country was ruled by the military junta from 1974 to 1983. Could you elaborate a little bit on that period, and how does that tie to modern Argentine politics?
Well, when you apply deflationary policies on an economy, such as the military had done, you know, in many countries when there had been a military coup, such as Pinochet, Videla, and so on, the way to sustain the economy is by massive indebtedness. Because if you don't get into debt, you haven't got resources to maintain whatever it is that is available and is still around. So that explains that one. Nevertheless, later on, Néstor Kirchner, if I can move further forward, as it were, was able to, by using Venezuelan bonds, was able to actually sort out the IMF and more or less pay the external debt almost completely. Except there were a few ones, a few parts of the debt that had been sold in the secondary market. That is to say, those who actually loaned the money in the first place were not the owners any longer. And those who actually owned the or bought the debt are known as vulture funds, or vulture loaners, or sharks, which I think sharks is better. And well, Kirchner and Cristina, first of all, Néstor and then Cristina, were not prepared to pay this. And this was a long litigation, and there was somebody mobilized, a judge, a guy called Griega in New York, who actually ruled that this should be paid. And as a consequence, you know, the whole IMF and so on fell on Argentina, but they resisted this until Macri was elected. When Macri was elected, he accepted the voucher funds right away. He paid immediately, and the debt began to escalate. And as a consequence of this, they have to pay significant amount of money in interest rate and so on. So what he did, he got more into debt. And overall, he took the external, the public debt of Argentina to an extraordinary $280 billion, which is just extraordinary. And as a consequence of that, that was the legacy he left. The IMF loan money, impose more packages of austerity, and so on, in the usual fashion. And then this continues with Alberto Fernandez. Alberto Fernandez, rather than resisting or organizing some form of resistance to get a better bargaining position with the IMF, accepted their conditions. And as a consequence of that, Argentina began to fall further and further into the. My understanding is at the moment the debt of Argentina is $420 billion, which is absolutely horrific. Mm-hmm. So they intend to deal, you know, Milei and company intend to deal with this. Most of the money that was borrowed by Macri during his administration actually ended up, I'm not sure how much, but a substantial amount ended up in fiscal paradises. The money came in, went through very shady channels and ended up somewhere else outside Argentina. And the solution to that was to borrow more money, which did exactly the same. So the consequence was the country was depleted from fiscally, and Alberto Fernandez had to deal with this. And one of the mechanisms was to actually support people with social security and so on, which is what Milei intends to cut back massively. So you can imagine this is brewing an extraordinary confrontation. And given the militancy of the Argentinian working class, I expect some serious turbulences to take place there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Milei said that he felt completely supported by the armed forces, but he also warned that the first 6 months to the first year were going to be incredibly harsh. And he used this sort of neoliberal jargon, you know, the patient is ill, and the therapy, it's going to be shock therapy, etc., etc. I'm just wondering if you could go back to the period of Néstor Kirchner and Cristina Fernández, because they were in power between 2003, Nestor first in 2003 to 2007, and then Cristina from 2007 to 2015. I understand that under Nestor Kirchner, Argentina did probably better since the time of the first Perón government in terms of nationalizations, in terms of investing in large infrastructure programs, social programs. But by the time Cristina is leaving office, and then when she returns back in 2019, there's a political expenditure that has taken place that has affected the ability of the Argentine population to, I guess, see clearly or see the difference between the two, you know, these two camps. Could you tell us a little bit more? And also, I'm interested in knowing a little bit more about the judicial processes that have been taken place, because it's a very politicized judicial process, which I think is the similarities to Lula in Brazil are sort of quite clear. Use the judiciary to discredit political figures that are a threat to the establishment.
Yeah. The performance of Kirchner and then Cristina, you know, Nestor and then Cristina, was pretty impressive. They had, as it were, massive resources from Venezuela, but not exclusively. This was not the only reason why they did what they did. They engaged in infrastructure works, which generated jobs, improved the income of the working class quite massively, reduced poverty. You remember poverty before with those people who actually were picking up, you know, the piqueteros that were picking up, you know, things to recycle and so on, which was horrible at the time. Well, all of this was massively reduced as a consequence, you know, serious, vigorous state intervention in the economy. And it was performing extremely well. And this was part and parcel of what was going on in the whole region. Between, say, to use some figures, between 1990 and 2013, the level of poverty in the whole of Latin America went from 48% in 1990 to something like 26% in 2013, 2014, including all the way to 2016. And this was going down, the trend was downwards. So Argentina, being a strong economy, benefited massively. The problem was capitalism. And I don't mean that in a sort of propagandistic way. The capitalists between 2005 and 2008 engaged in a massive speculation of every kind imaginable everywhere, and the consequence was the credit crunch in 2009. So the United States and their accomplices, they decided to take advantage of these difficulties, or the difficulties that this credit crunch created everywhere, you know, in Latin America as well as elsewhere, particularly Latin America, that depended so heavily, still depends very heavily on the exportation of raw materials, in order to use the discourse of the left to criticize the governments of the left that actually couldn't deliver, you know, in the same fashion with the social program. And this happened to Dilma Rousseff around about the same time, 2013, 14, 15, 16. You remember she was impeached finally in 2016, and Cristina suffered exactly the same consequences. No matter how much they tried to sort things out, they just couldn't. So Macri, you know, particularly the Macri current, used all the difficulties created in order to defeat Cristina electorally, not Cristina, but, you know, the Peronists, that current. And as a consequence, Macri came into power. So that explains not only what happened in Argentina, but also what happened in Brazil, in Honduras, Paraguay, and so on. There was this, people I remember were writing at the time, "The Empire Strikes Back," because they were winning one after another. And they made significant, substantial score, even the last one of that wave of imperialist recovery of the region was Bolivia in 2019. The advantage that we on the progressive side have is that the right wing, when they come in, they cannot consolidate because what they offer is horrific. Mm-hmm. And I think you can see what Bolsonaro did, what Jeanine Añez did in Bolivia, and so on. And if one were to compare the intensity and retrograde nature of what it was proposed by Jair Bolsonaro, I think Milei surpasses them all in quantity, quality, and content. So therefore, you know, we have to expect something quite dramatic. It is possible that they recover later on, the Peronists, but that's not easy.
I understand he has a large following amongst the youth in Argentina, and that I find interesting, but obviously disturbing. What could you tell us about the youth following that he has in the country, and trying to argue for a revised version of Argentine history in terms of the deaths and the disappeared under the military regime?
I think it's a very temporary phenomenon. I don't think he's got the youth on his side. I haven't looked at the figures in terms of, you know, age, button patterns in the last election. We have to be aware that the media project particular dimensions, and they want to suggest that because all the previous politicians failed miserably, then this new sort of fresh blood is attractive, you know, is managing to attract the youth. In Argentina, the youth of the middle class, and the middle class are terrifically, terrifically reactionary. They are the most cultured one in the whole continent. At the same time, they are the most reactionary one. So I wouldn't be surprised if there would be sections of the youth, particularly in Buenos Aires, which is, you know, the capital city of Latin America, as it were, that could be attracted to that sort of simplistic answers that Milei was proposing. But I don't think this is a definite thing, because if you take into account, you know, the level of poverty in Argentina, which is what is there now, is 40%. And it's these 40% of people that were being supported by them, that makes a substantial proportion of the youth in the country anyway. I doubt very much that these people are going to be very enamored with what Milei is proposing. It is possible that they felt attracted temporarily from simplistic answers, but I don't think it's going to be a phenomenon that's going to last too long. But remember, to use a comparison, if I may, when Jair Bolsonaro won in Brazil, people believed, particularly Brazilians, friends of mine, believed that, you know, fascism was going to descend on Brazil forever, for the next 50, 60, 70 years. And I remember saying to them, not that I knew all of the answers, but I remember saying to them, how can they consolidate this with what they're proposing? It's not possible. If one were to look at Nazi examples such as Germany, you know, Adolf Hitler proposed the regeneration of the nation, which he did, reindustrialized, regenerated it, create employment, and so on. These people have very little to propose, except pillage, except corruption, except brutality, except neoliberal policies and impoverishment. How can you consolidate anything? And as a consequence, you can see that the right wing has been unable to actually consolidate. They consolidate their rule once they make gains. In Brazil, Bolsonaro was defeated by somebody who had been in prison. In Bolivia, you know, the Jeanine Añez government lasted 11 months. So I think Argentina, I don't think it's going to be a long-term phenomenon, but we have to wait and see for developments to take place.
Yeah, they definitely don't seem to be able to consolidate those victories. And certainly, as you say, their economic policies are disastrous. People may forget, but, you know, for observers like yourself and myself, we can see patterns. So that's definitely interesting and to some extent predictable. I'm still wondering, though, to what extent will Milei be able to reshape regional politics, and will he really strengthen the regional right, or do you think his government could possibly collapse midterm?
I don't want to predict their collapse because it's too premature to say too much. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first measures have been taken only in the last 2-3 days. So therefore, mm-hmm. you know, we have to wait and see how they work out. nevertheless, his proposal to break with Brazil commercially would have had gigantic consequences. He wouldn't have stopped the process of regional integration and progressive politics that is taking place in the region anyway. Nevertheless, it would have complicated it substantially. But then he backtracked very quickly on that. Although he promised all of this, he hasn't done it. And he said he was not going to invite Lula to his inauguration. And then he said, if he wants to come, he's welcome. And then later on, he went very courteous, you know, invitation, which is a bit sycophantic in my view, the last one. So that's an indication that other forces are coming in. And I would say the other forces are Macri and company, who are coming in and saying, look, when it comes to electoral propaganda, what you were doing was fine. When it comes to real politics and real economics, you have to do something else. I think he decided to do exactly the same with China, decided not to break commercially with China. After all, 92% of the export of soy and 57% of the exports of meat go to China. And these are two absolutely central exports of Argentina. If that were to be stopped, you know, the country would definitely collapse. The problem, I think, arises in the prospect of one organizing UNASUR or reorganizing UNASUR, which is obviously a very important plank of the regional integration process that progressive forces on the left want to see in the continent. They might complicate that. We'll see how it goes. And the second one is the proposal. I think this is going to be more complicated. Lula proposed to Alberto Fernandez the setting up of a sort of cryptocurrency to engage in their mutual trade, to settle their mutual trade, which was going to be the basis to create a single cryptocurrency for the whole of Latin America. That's a proposal, which means you have to create a bank, set up a bank, which was a proposal made by Chavez, you know, several years ago, which Lula didn't take seriously at the time. He said in the electoral campaign, Lula, that actually he had been mistaken by not taking that proposal seriously. So now he's pushing very hard on this. And he's totally determined, this is Lula, to de-dollarize, you know, foreign trade. Now, that's where the United States may come in with Macri and others to influence Milei and say, okay, we may continue commerce with them, but we're not going to engage in this serious stuff. We'll see how it goes. It will be very bad if this were to be stopped. So Brazil will have to think of other partners with whom to actually organize this, which it will. Because this is not going to stop. There's plenty of possibilities around the world with BRICS, Venezuela, Mexico, and so on, to do it with. But it can complicate things very dramatically in that sense.
Interesting. And for our audience who may not know what UNASUR is, it's the Union of South American Nations, which was established in 2009, if my memory serves me correctly, with the objective to 2008, with the objective to provide a counterbalance to the OAS, the Organization of American States, where all the big debates are held in the region when there are crises.
Yeah, allow me a footnote here, because the moment it was established in 2008, the first meeting that it took place in Santiago under Michel Bachelet. And the first action of UNASUR was to actually denounce the attempt to break Bolivia into two parts organized by the United States. And as a consequence of that action by UNASUR, then that was defeated. You know, yes. So to have that organization makes a lot of difference than not to have it.
Yes, yes, I would certainly agree with that. Dr. Francisco Dominguez, former senior lecturer at Middlesex University, Thank you so much for joining us here at Indestructible, Alborada's Indestructible podcast, Indestructible podcast. I've read your works for many years and admired your work, so I am honored, and it's been an absolute pleasure to converse with you these topics.
Thank you very much. The honor is all mine. Thank you, Rodrigo. Delighted to have been invited.
Thank you. As always, I would like to thank Alborada for this opportunity to host Indestructible, Indestructible. My sincere thanks, as always, goes to Alborada's founder and co-editor, Pablo Navarrete, who produces this podcast. If you have any comments on this episode, please write to us on our email, which you will find on Alborada's website. Next year, we'll be back with episode 25, which will be the final episode for Indestructible podcast. Unfortunately, like most independent media projects, the first few years of production are crucial in deciding whether small projects like Indestructible Podcast are viable in the long term or not. After much consideration, due to our serious time constraints and commitments to other projects, Pablo and I have decided to conclude this podcast at episode 25. While there are so many other stories from Latin America that we would have liked to have covered and believe need to be told, we are proud of the small body of work that Indestructible Podcast leaves behind. We are especially thankful to all of our listeners who have supported this project. Until we return with the final episode in early 2024, goodbye and stay safe.